pull this up with a little gag line and some jokes?
Well, you know, well,
how do you get?
Well, the first question. That's why I see other people here.
Can think you have any chance in the race? No, I don't think I do.
Okay. The first question is, now this is your third Iditarod, third attempt at the Iditarod, and I wonder what after reading some of Tim Jones's book, I often wonder what some of your fondest memories from past Iditarods were. Maybe the fondest, if you could pin it down to that. If not, maybe you could just run through some of the ones that you thought were really memorable.
How much time are you going to be on the air?
Oh, I didn't mean to.
You could edit these things out, right? So
yeah.
You could make this just, you can click in anywhere you want, huh?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, the best memory is, of course, I think, you know, the second time that I ran the race and finished and got off the trail in Nome, because it took one time two-thirds of the way and another time all the way to get there. So it was about a 1,700-mile race for me, because I spread it out over two different races over 3 years. So certainly that was the best memory, to be done with it that second time and have completed the whole trail.
In 1979, you made a pretty famous comment that has been put in print by Tim Jones at the beginning of the race. Maybe would you care to just sort of repeat it?
Well, I was just told before I was about to be interviewed at the drawing before the second race by my wife that as I was heading toward the stage, she said, "Tell him that," or I guess she told me, "If you don't get to know him, don't come home." And so that was my message.
During the 1979 race, you sort of helped a lot of people along the trail. I mean, you're sort of a casual guy, we'll say, sort of laid back. Maybe that's an understatement. But in any event, you sort of, you took it easy, you and the guys back at the executive camping trip. And I understand that you sort of helped some people along the trail. Maybe you could tell us about those experiences, sort of like with the Flemings and helping, I'm not sure which guy it was that was in pretty bad shape, but helping him out.
Well, we started that race, Jim Lanier and I, pretty much planning on getting to know him as best we could and probably together. We had kind of a pact that we'd stay together probably at least until McGrath, no matter what. And then if the dogs were of a substantially different caliber or something changed things, then from that point on, everybody was on their own if they chose to be. But we got to McGrath together and left together and really didn't have any way to break apart. The pace of the team was about the same, and we were helping each other with feeding so that it was a little easier on everybody, and just pretty much decided to stay together through there. And we had fallen back in the pack quite a ways, and there were several other people in McGrath at that time, one of which knew the coast pretty well and was going the same pace we were when we hit McGrath, and we asked him if he'd want to come along, because I knew the next section of the trail real well and thought maybe that would help him, and then he might help us on the coast. So he fell in with us to pretty much stay together, and that was Prentice Harris from Nome, and he knew the coast side of the trail, so that's how we got partially formed up. And then Don Montgomery had left McGrath three times the day that we were planning to leave in the evening, and when we were ready to go in the evening after his third time out and back and missing the trail to Takotna, he decided he'd follow in with us because maybe we could find the trail to Takotna. So that's how Don joined up with us. And then Gene Leonard would have been the last one in town, and he only had six dogs with him, I think six or seven total, and he said only about three of those were ever pulling at the same time. And we knew we'd be leaving him totally behind if we took off, so we invited him to join us up and see how well he could keep up with us, and that's how the group left McGrath. Everybody kind of tied together. We stayed that way the rest of the race. We helped Gene a lot, but we didn't really help him get to Nome. We just helped by being around so that he wasn't left so far behind that if the weather changed, you know, for the worse, that he wouldn't have somebody helping him break the trail. The weather never did affect us that much as far as trail, so he made it to Nome with those dogs all by himself, and we just set our pace so that we were, you know, in front or behind him, not so far away that he couldn't, you know, count on a little help if he did have problems. His only problem was that his dogs were slow. The story, I don't know if you want that kind of story, but he had a pretty...
Wait, before you start that, you got...
Okay, now you were going to tell a story about I think, Gene, or maybe your executive camping trip there.
Well, I just... going to relate how Gene Laird got himself into that kind of a fix. About 6 or 8 weeks before the race started that year, he had, I guess, 10 or 12 dogs that he'd gathered up from Iditarod teams that had passed through his home as a checkpoint over a couple of years, and they were, I guess, reasonably strong dogs, kind of a ragtag team, but pretty strong and ready to go. And he was just mushing across from his home at Finger Lake over to Squintna to take a little of the trail in and say hello to Joe Delia. And I'm not sure if it was on his way over or on his way back, but he got out there about halfway between the two points. Maybe it's a 8-hour run normally, and it snowed on him, and it snowed, and it snowed, and I guess it snowed something like 3.5 feet in a matter of a half a day, and he was stuck. And it took him... I think something like 7 days to get out. And of course he was in there with, you know, like one day's supplies. He had the food on his sled and that was all. So 6 or 7 days he was there breaking a trail to get back to his home. And during that time, all of his dogs went without food as he did. And his dog team basically was, you know, wiped out in that event or in that circumstance, and he really never had the chance to get them all fattened back up and make them as good as they were. And so then when he started off on the race, because of what had happened to the dogs then, he had to drop them because they didn't have the strength. And when he left his checkpoint and his home at Finger Lake, he left half of his team there behind and left with six or seven dogs headed for Nome. And like I say, from that point on, there were never more than three of those dogs pulling, ever. He'd go faster. How did that go? He'd go faster on the uphill sides of the trail because he could push the sled faster than the three dogs pulling could drag it down a hill. So he made better time going uphill on that 700 miles from his house onto Nome than on the uphill parts than he did on the flats or on the downhill. He was pushing the sled all by himself.
On the 79 race, and what was the other one, 78?
77, I guess.
Yeah. Do you have any different strategy for 1983?
I don't know how I'd say that. 77, I really didn't know what I was doing. Had a great time, spent at least 12 hours in every checkpoint, some longer. Then mushed all day or all night or whatever, straight through. Didn't know you had to stop and feed the dogs as much as I learned later you have to. I took care of them and they seemed to be all right, but it was a funny kind of mushing, just point to point, and then spend a lot of time at the checkpoints visiting, trying to find out how you were supposed to do it. So I didn't have any strategy the first time. Second time my strategy was very simple, and that was, you know, get there. And stay at it. And Jim Lanier was very helpful in that because I'm not really well known for, you know, getting up in the morning or getting out of bed once I had a chance to get to sleep. And so Jim was the alarm clock. He had about 3 hours of time that he could lay down, and then he'd wake up and couldn't go back to sleep, and he'd start rustling around and start rustling me around, and he'd manage to shake me up and, you know, get me up every morning more out of guilt than anything else, or every night. And I guess, you know, that was what kept me moving as well as we did that year, and we were almost last. So that's what set that blistering 24-day pace.
What about this year then? Do you think you going for the same strategy then? 79, you know, just to finish. Are you going to be part of the take on the executive camping trip mentality, or are you going to try to be a little more competitive? What are the goals?
Well, this year my alarm clock isn't Jim Lanier. My alarm clock's going to be my son, who's in the race also, and he's. He's a little more enthusiastic about going a little quicker, and if he can move as fast as he thinks he can go, and keep me awake and keep me up and going, I'll go as fast as he can go, and we'll try and stay together. So maybe we'll, you know, move up a ways and not end up in the rear where we're holding people up or keeping people at the checkpoint. So we'll just see how far up we move. Depends on how fast he's willing to go.
How do you feel about that, having your son run the Iditarod? I think there's only been probably one other father and son team, and that's Dick and Rick Mackey. And Rick was a little bit older, I think, than Robert is here.
Yeah, there have been as many as three Reddingtons on the trail all at once, and two Mackeys, so this isn't a unique thing with father and son, but I guess it's one of the youngest sons of a prior Iditarodder that's made the event, and so it's a little bit unique in that way. I guess if I got him into it by suggesting, you know, that he might be interested in doing this while we're, you know, in this state, have the opportunity, have the dogs, and have the equipment that I've gathered up over the years fooling around with dogs, and if he wanted to go, not that he had to go, but if he wanted to go, we'd hold it together until he was old enough to go, which is this year. And so I've certainly encouraged him, and I hope not forced him. And so far, then, we've even waited this year till this point, which is pretty late, to sign up so that he doesn't feel like, because he's put his money in and there's, you know, a name in the paper and people say, ah, you're going, that he'd feel like he has to go if he really doesn't. So we've left that open even to this point. I want him to go because I think the experience of preparing for this and the experience of doing what it takes on the trail just to get to Nome, not even worrying about competitiveness, but just to get there and keep it all together and keep your mind wrapped around the circumstances so that you can get a dog team and yourself all there safely and all in good shape. And, you know, requires a good degree of concentration and a lot of determination that he may not realize now it takes, but he'll find out when he's on the trail. And when you go through that, it's a little, you know, it's a little passage, at least in terms of, you know, what you can prove or how you might surprise yourself is what you're capable of doing when you're up against something that maybe harder than you thought it was going to be, and finishing it up and doing it. So it's an experience he'll never forget. Even if he gets out there and has trouble and, you know, can't complete it, you know, if it's through no fault of his own, but, you know, luck and the brakes on the trail, he should never feel bad about it. And I think, you know, that's something that's a lesson for person's whole life when you're up against some things you can't control and figure out in your mind how to, you know, get something accomplished either in a different way or with materials at hand that you might never have thought of to use before to solve a problem. It's an experience that'll teach you an awful lot about yourself. And if at the same time you can see the country from that point of view rather than just flying city to city or driving up and down the highways, see the state out there and see some of the villages and things that he's never really had much exposure with, that's an eye-opener, and I think it's well worth it. The Iditarod committee, I'm sure, would, or maybe not the committee, but I shouldn't quite say it like that, but if you just look at it from the point of view of what you can do in an event like this, where you pay a nominal amount of money. It seems like a lot, but you know, $2,000, $3,000, or even $5,000 to have a partially sponsored, well thought out, logistically supported excursion across the state of Alaska with people checking where you are on radios, people flying back over the trail to be sure you're all right, you know, having things set up so that you have a place to stop when you go, all the activities that go on just the race, you couldn't pay a travel agency to set up for four times the money, and you'd probably only get a week's worth of fun out of it. This is a month of well-supported activity, and I think we're lucky to be able to even participate and have an organization that can set something like that up.
People who may not know you real well, but people who sort of encounter you might think that your sort of personality type might not be the type that would run the Iditarod. I mean, you're pretty laid back, real. Most of the other Iditarod mushers that you meet are real, I wouldn't call them hyper, but they seem, at least outwardly, to be a lot more intense. And they talk a lot more about the race and what they're doing and stuff like that. And I often wondered, I guess maybe what I'm trying to say is maybe you fool a lot of people. And I wonder why you do want to run the Iditarod. Why have you run it, you know, once before and attempted once before and now trying again?
Well, it's part of it's, you know, pride, and part of it's not knowing when to keep my mouth shut. I helped two or three people that raced in this before I even considered doing it. Terry Adkins, we helped a couple of times out of Anchorage when we knew him, you know, in 71, 72, about somewhere around in there. And we helped him, and he was inexperienced, didn't really know what he was doing at the beginning. Good veterinarian, but not a dog musher. And he took off, made it to Nome, and that gave me some hope that it could be done by people that haven't been living in the woods all their life. And he seemed to enjoy it. The people that were associated with him and with the race were pleasant people, and some of them tried. Steve Fee was one of the longest people on the trail, a late finisher, and seemed to enjoy it in spite of the hardships that the trail threw at him. And so I guess it prompted me to think that, you know, it's something that with some outdoor experience and reasonable dogs that anybody could attempt and give it a go. Not from my perspective to try and win it. The people that are trying to win it or are capable of winning it, you know, have what I'd consider some superhuman abilities. Certainly they're at the maximum of human abilities in the physical work and endurance that they put out, and they have fabulous dogs that they can, you know, they've worked with and put together that are also, you know, fabulous animals. And I just don't, you know, I never perceive myself competing against that portion or that group of people in the race. I wanted to take the trail, and it wasn't, you know, what I'd call a macho kind of thing, because, you know, I never figured it was all that rough if you were taking it with the perspective of being safe and doing the best you could. And we lived in the north side of the Alaska Range for 4 or 5 years, or 3 years, I guess, before I got into this the first time. You know, we trained and mushed dogs in cold weather, you know, and fed them and taken care of them at 50 and 60 below, and, you know, a 30 below day in those years was a warm day, and a 10 below day was a dream for a lot of the winter. So the cold part of the trail, that kind of weather, you know, didn't bother me, didn't even faze me anymore. I'd been used to it, so I wasn't fearful of that on this race course at all. And the interior weather You know, it's really pretty mild as far as heavy snows. Usually, you know, so you don't get a blizzard like I might have in the Midwest. I'd never do a thing across this, like across Nebraska. But, you know, the weather would kill you down there, but it's really, by comparison, pretty calm in the interior. And Anchorage is always, after a few years on this side of the range, you know, mild. It's like a summer vacation when you get to Anchorage to start this race. So weather wasn't a factor. I wanted to see the country, and I told some people, I guess I better think I'll go. And then pretty soon they said, well, you're going, aren't you? And pretty soon I couldn't say no. So I signed up and on the way, and mostly because I couldn't keep my mouth shut. Very nervous right before each of the events, especially the first one, because I was pretty inexperienced. But then after the first one, getting as far as I did with a lot of luck, good weather, and, you know, dogs that basically trained up on the trail. I had some miles on them before. I wasn't cruel to them, I don't think, but, you know, they and I learned a lot in those 500 miles. And the second time then was a matter of, you know, if you can go that far hardly knowing anything, and now you do know something and you know who to ask and you can learn more, you know, let's put this thing under your belt and finish it, just so that it's something that you can say, not only were you, you know, in it and around it, but you went the whole distance on the trail. I don't know that I'd be going again this year if Robert hadn't, you know, through these years said, you know, I think I'd like to, and then it's worked out that the timing and the dogs and all have pretty well made it possible to do it. But I don't know that I'd be going again, because I can't be competitive. I don't have the time nor the money to put that kind of team together, and I don't want to be at the rear so that I'm, you know, holding up people in checkpoints. And maybe a month from now you ask me that same question, why, if I feel like, would I do it again even this year, I might say I might feel better about it a month ago than I do now, because it's really hard to look out a window when it's dark at 4 in the afternoon and 45 degrees below zero and think that I really want to go out and run dogs, you know, anywhere. It's a cold and a bleak time, but 2 months, 12 hours of sunlight, it gets to be springtime, and then I guess it'll look pretty good.
Just the last question, that might be for like another story, but what is it like, how do you think the Iditarod is different for those at the front of the pack and those in the back of the pack?
Well, I guess it depends on where the people at the back of the pack thought they would be when they started the race. You know, and I've been far enough along in the race, maybe for a day or two, you know, in the first week, where I was with more mushers than I ended up being with when there was just a few of us left and we were the last ones on the trail. And the people that thought they could end up in the top 20 or the front third or in the money, who thought they could, and, you know, because they weren't prepared or because they had bad luck, who fell back into the back group, some of them were quite disappointed, and not a lot of fun to be around for a while, because they'd had a lot higher expectation than the way things turned out. For most of the people that I ended up traveling with both years, if they'd entered with the idea that, you know, if they're lucky they do a little bit well, but they really weren't ever thinking that they'd be anywhere but the middle third and hope they could stay out of the back third. The people that went into it to finish it and weren't ever thinking about winning it at the beginning were a pleasure to travel with, because they were, you know, right where they kind of expected to be, maybe, you know, 10 places back. Maybe they didn't want to be in that last five, but they were quite content. They were doing more than they thought they might even then. And traveling with some of those folks was a dream. You know, they were just delightful. And even the ones that were disappointed and had fallen back to the rear, after a couple of 3 days, when they kind of regrouped from the disappointment and then said, well, with what I got, I can still probably make it. And you could see their, you know, their mental gears slowing a bit and readjusting. And then when their goal again became what mine was from the very beginning, even when I thought about racing it, just getting in it and finishing it. And when their goal became just to do that with what they had left, they became, you know, very pleasant people again. And the gentleman's camping party, half of that group was disappointed mushers who, after a few days of getting over their disappointment while they were on the trail, then fell right in and just said, let's make it to Nome and let's enjoy it as best we can, but let's keep moving to the point that we don't ever have a trail ahead of us that's open and we're fooling around, you know. So we didn't sleep when there was good trail, and we didn't oversleep or, you know, stay down a long time anywhere. We did move along and make a concerted effort, you know, to keep going. And we were only slowed then by the pace of the one musher. And we all, you know, essentially made a pact that we wouldn't leave that fellow behind because of his spirit and his determination. And you just couldn't leave somebody like that as the last person and let the trail wipe them out or stop them when a few people around them just breaking trail a little bit might be the difference. So I'm not quite sure if I even ended up answering what you asked me.
Yeah, you did. It's 2 months to go, and while many people are still out looking for sponsors, you're one of the few mushers I've ever heard of that's still looking for dogs. How are you handling that in your typical laid back, it'll be all right style?
Well, I was thinking about it yesterday because that's when I got the news that, you know, maybe about six dogs that I was kind of counting on to fill out my team, because most of the dogs I have will be in my son's team and I'm taking what's left. Anyhow, that, I was looking for a total of 12 or 13 dogs and kind of counting on six from another source, and that just hasn't worked out. But then, you know, well, it's a disappointment, but it also, I think, might have done more for my attitude about this particular race than anything else could, because all of a sudden it's not just something that my son's doing a lot of the dog training and somebody else is going to give me some partially trained dogs and I'm going to get on the back and go with them and work them a little more and take off. I've all of a sudden, you know, got to fight for this a little bit. So getting on the phone and starting to call people yesterday, letting them know my dilemma, made me think, you know, well, this is something you got to work at even now, and makes me, you know, a little more inspired, actually. It was maybe a little too easy before this minor setback, so.
I have one more that I'm just dying to ask. This is the last one. You're a pretty avid smoker, and I wonder, do you have, you know, everywhere you have these emergency packs stashed and stuff, what do you do, what kind of preparations do you have for the Iditarod? And I've often wondered what it's like to try and smoke like at 45 or 50 below.
Well, I have the Iditarod really to blame for smoking cigarettes, because I quit cigarettes for 2 or 3 years, and I smoked cigars pretty heavily, but probably, well, maybe I even smoked them as much as I smoked cigarettes, but at least I wasn't smoking these things. But I couldn't keep the cigars from freezing and cracking the first race, so I did the best I could and borrowed cigarettes out there on the trail, because all my cigars were broken up and freeze-dried, so to speak, and it was pretty tough to keep them lit and all the ashes and stuff fall back in your face. So then I ran out of borrowed cigarettes in Flat when we were trying to get a plane out that year when I scratched and fell there along with a can of snuff. I hadn't in your face, so then I ran out of borrowed cigarettes in Flat when we were trying to get a plane out that year when I scratched and fell there along with a can of snuff. I hadn't the slightest idea what to do with snuff. It's kind of like dried up sawdust kind of stuff, and I'd keep putting it in my mouth, and about 2 miles down the trail, I'd swallow it. It was, you know, really kind of revolting. So when I got back, I stayed with cigars for the next year and a half, basically. I smoked them straight through the rendezvous, and then it's just something in your mouth to chew on, keeps you from being nervous. Half the time, wasn't even lit. But when I outfitted for the Iditarod the second time, I wasn't about to go through that again, so I went out and bought my Salems and put two packs in every bag and started having emergency packs hidden in my gear and took off and smoked my way all the way to Nome. And, you know, there's a certain pleasantness when it's 40, 50 below out there, and you know, there's at least there's a little heat in the end of that cigarette, and if you see that, you know that you know, you're not quite totally away from all sources of comfort. I don't probably work. I know I don't work as hard as a lot of people do on the trail, but I always push uphill, and I kick a little bit on the flats, and downhill I coast and let them do the work. But you know, I've never gone hard enough, I guess, or really had to work hard enough that these have gotten in the way.
Okay. Well, Jeffrey, you're sort of in. What's it like having a father? First, you had your father run the race, run it once, run it twice, finish and everything, and now your brother's running it. What's it like to have two people in the family running the Iditarod?
Well, it's kind of a mess because, you know, we're not very organized and we just kind of do things as they come along, and I imagine we'll be up about 6 nights before the race just getting everything ready.
Do you ever get, you know, it seems to me that with dog mushing, there's no middle ground. It's like it's all absorbing and there's no room pretty much for anything else. What's it like being in part of that? Now obviously, you know, Rob and Ron aren't exactly the real hypers and fanatics on dog mushing, but I imagine that the talk about the Iditarod goes pretty long hours and people talk about it and stuff. How do you feel about that, like not being part of it? Are you just glad that, you know, you're not involved in it, or do you feel sometimes that maybe you'd like to run it, or what?
Well, I'm very glad that I'm in no way involved in this. Because, well, like my dad, you know, he's laid back. And, you know, he'll take it as he comes. But my brother, he's pretty hyper about this. And he's I think he'll do pretty good out there.
Do you have any advice for people that might be listening to this that, you know, that are in families where, you know, you sound like the rational one in this family. Do you have any advice for people that, you know, that have to sort of cope with the fact that people are running the Iditarod?
Well, if there's any way to not become involved with it, then just do that and just try and stay away from it if you're that kind of person. Because, you know, I'm not into this, whereas they are, and it might be right for them, but it's not right for me.
What do you think about them running the Iditarod?
Well, I think it'd probably be a good experience for my brother to do that, because he's never done that. You know, it'd be a growth experience, but I don't think my dad needs to do it again after completing the race.
Oh, the only thing you need to know is your age. Mm-hmm. Okay, what are some of you were talking about some of the funnier events on the trail there?
Well, I just wanted to know, you know, in the course of an interview like this, if we have time to tell any of the things that are a little bit funny rather than just memorable. Yeah. The first time I took off in this? Yeah, the first time I took off in this in 77, I really wasn't quite ready, you know, for the start. We had started on Big Lake, and I was still packing my sled when they were calling the number for the team to show up in the chute. And because I was acting pretty calm about it, my mother really didn't realize. She'd come up from Nebraska to see me off in this thing and didn't know too much about it. She didn't realize that that close to leaving. The dogs had been harnessed up, my handlers had done that, and I was still packing the sled, and she thought we had maybe half hour, an hour before I took off. And she was standing up a little bit in front of the sled, and near the dogs, and all of a sudden I pulled the rope because they called my number for the shoot, and I was due straight in, and so I just pulled the rope and took off, and she was standing on what she thought to be the side, and the sled went sideways and clipped her good, knocked her down flat in the snow, and the camera she was taking pictures with kind of disappeared in the snow, and I couldn't stop anything. We were on a little bit of ice, so I went right on by, and then she realized things were going to happen pretty soon, but didn't think I'd be leaving right away. And she ran as fast as she could up to the starting line. By then, my number was down to go, and all I could do is turn around and wave and say goodbye. And I guess all she could do for about the next 10 minutes was stand around and say, "He's gone. He's really gone."